Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI invites the faithful to make an attitude change with regard to following Christ. On the 15th anniversary of the 1995 Srebrenica massacre, the survivor of a concentration camp in Bosnia-Herzegovina talks about his life, his thoughts, and the importance of remembering. And South African Cardinal Wilfred Fox Napier wraps up the just-ended Football World Championship, which he says has left a lasting legacy to his nation. Pope Benedict XVI reflected on the parable of the Good Samaritan and invited the faithful to make an attitude change with regard to following Christ. As Chris Altieri reports, the Pope was addressing the faithful on Sunday before praying the midday Angelus.
The Holy Father made his remarks at the traditional Angelus prayer with the faithful gathered in the courtyard of the Apostolic Palace at Castel Gandolfo, where the Pope is spending the summer months. The Gospel reading this Sunday was the parable of the Good Samaritan, and Pope Benedict remarked on the passage, saying, "The example of the Samaritan must inspire us to transform our thinking according to the logic of Christ, which is the logic of love."
La parabola pertanto deve indurci.
God is love, said the Holy Father, and to give him worship means to serve one's brethren with generous and sincere love. The program of the Christian, said Pope Benedict, is a heart that sees where there is need of love and acts accordingly.
Il programma del cristiano.
After the prayer of Marian devotion, the Holy Father greeted pilgrims in many languages, including English.
To be Christians means to be faithful to the words and example of Jesus, especially by living a life of love of God and neighbor. May the Lord give us grace and courage so that we may always respond generously as good Samaritans to the needs of all who suffer near and far.
The Holy Father is scheduled to remain in Castel Gandolfo through the month of September. I'm Chris Altieri.
Thanks there to Chris Altieri for that report. Thousands of people, including survivors of the 1995 Srebrenica massacre, set off on a symbolic three-day march last week to the eastern Bosnian town, ahead of events marking the 15th anniversary of the crime on Sunday, July the 11th. They retraced the path taken over hills and through dense forests by some 15,000 Bosnian Muslim men trying to escape mass killings in Srebrenica after the town, which had been declared a United Nations safe haven in 2003, was overrun by Bosnian Serb forces on July the 11th, 1995. Hundreds were killed along that path 15 years ago, as the exhausted men were under almost constant machine gun and artillery fire while trying to flee to the territory then controlled by Bosniak-led government forces. In Srebrenica itself, Serbs separated over 8,000 Bosniak men and boys from women, summarily executed them over the following days, and dumped their bodies in a number of mass graves. I too would like to commemorate those victims, and to do so, my thanks go to Vatican Radio's Lydia O'Kane for the moving interview you are about to listen to, with Kemal Pirvanic, a Bosnian Muslim who was persecuted and suffered at the hands of Radovan Karadzic and military forces during the deadly 1992-1995 conflict that followed Bosnia-Herzegovina's secession from Yugoslavia. A conflict which included the Srebrenica massacre and a bloody 44-month siege of Sarajevo. This interview was actually conducted just after the arrest of Radovan Karadzic, the former Bosnian Serb president, who was accused of masterminding ethnic cleansing, deportations and killings of Bosnian Muslims and Croats. He was arrested in July 2008, after more than a decade in hiding, and charged with genocide, crimes against humanity and violations of the law of war. He is still on trial. As I just mentioned, Lydia O'Kane spoke to Kemal Pervanic, a Bosnian Muslim and survivor of that war, during which he was sent to two concentration camps. She started by asking him of his thoughts regarding the arrest.
Did you ever think you would see the day when Radovan Karadzic would be arrested?
Well, I always wanted to believe that the day would come when, you know, I would see Karadzic being arrested. I'm pleased it's finally happened. Unfortunately, I think this has happened 12 years too late. Had it happened 12 years ago, I believe that Bosnia and all of its citizens, regardless of them being Serbs, Muslims and Croats, would be able to make a much better progress over the last 12 years. And especially young Bosnians, young, you know, Serbs in particular, there's a whole new generation of young Serb teenagers who were either born during the war or after the war, and who don't remember what kind of life we lived before the war, togetherness that existed between all different nationalities and religions. And these young people don't remember what happened during the war. Unfortunately, they know what they are told by their parents. And the prevailing belief in the Serb community, at least the Serb community where I come from the northwest of Bosnia, is that they themselves were the real victims of this war. And on my journeys back to Bosnia, I can see these young Serbs sporting images of Karadzic on their T-shirts because he's their national hero. And for me, most of these teenagers are what I called a lost generation.
Yes, it is important to remember and to tell things as they really were. In Kemal's words, when he grew up, ethnicity was never an issue. His school contained both Serbs and Muslims in mixed classes, and life was simple, until March 1992, when Radovan Karadzic and his followers established Serbian Bosnia-Herzegovina, and the newly named Bosnian Serb army began targeting Muslims within Kemal's region. His village put up no opposition to the forces, but the men were rounded up, including Kemal and his brother Kasim, and sent to a concentration camp at Omarska.
Kemal, if I may, take you back to that experience all those years ago during the war, the concentration camp experience. Perhaps if you could describe what it was like during that period, around that time, the sufferings, the hardships during that time, and also what it was like, the conditions in those camps.
Well, before the war reached my village, or even before the war, life was really good, in spite of the big economic crisis, because, you know, I lived in a very mixed community and we had no problems with each other whatsoever. There were mixed marriages as well. And when the war started and when I saw images of persecutions against Muslims in eastern Bosnia, I really didn't believe that something like that was going to happen to me, because I thought, you know, these are my neighbors, my friends, my former schoolmates. And I had a chance to leave, but I decided to stay behind. And then, unfortunately, in late May, it did happen to me. And my village was completely emptied. Nobody stayed behind. Women and children were separated from what Serb nationalists call men of fighting age. Even some of those detained with me were 13 or 14 years old. And we were bused to different locations, and I ended up in a disused iron ore mine. And there were several thousand other people who were detained with me at this facility. And the conditions in this camp were horrible. I was kept with about 500 other men in one room of relatively small proportions. And at the beginning, there wasn't enough space to sit on the floor. So if I wanted to you know, catch a nap, then I had to lean against my neighbor because there was no space on the floor. There was very little food in the camp, and it wasn't proper food. For example, on most days, we would be given one meal. On some days, there was no food at all. You would get a bowl of lukewarm soup with, you know, the number of peas you could count on fingers of your hands, and a little piece of stale bread, or, you know, the same kind of thing with several leaves of cabbage and so on. the hygiene in the camp was non-existent. We never had a chance to, you know, wash ourselves. We always wore the same clothes. The place became infested with lice. Towards the end of the camp, because of all the dirt, dysentery became rampant.
But Kamal says these were not the worst things he put up with.
The worst thing of all was that all of this was conducted by our former neighbours, and the camp was guarded by my former schoolmates, by the former policeman on whose protection I relied before the war started. And these people, you know, former neighbours and schoolmates, turned into murderers. And, you know, there was no rhyme or reason why somebody else was tortured and killed and why I'm still alive and talking to you today.
The brutality that was perpetrated, he says, is difficult to describe.
They would take someone out, whether they suspected this person was involved in something or if somebody held a grudge against this person, you know, they would take him out, they would torture him and perhaps kill him. But sometimes, you know, people would be tortured for days on end, and then finally, when they had enough, they would kill this person. And there was also a number of women that were kept in the camp, and I always say they suffered more than me, because I believe they were raped on a daily basis. According to some figures that I received from some friends who are searching for the missing people from my municipality, nearly 1,000 people were executed in this camp in those 2.5 months. It took me years after I was released to deal with what happened in this camp, because I just couldn't understand how something like this was possible, because we didn't do anything wrong. And
Kemal, the day you were taken to this camp must be a day that you relive for the rest of your life. But were you rounded up? Was there a particular form in which you were in which you were taken to this camp?
When I look back at what happened in Bosnia in those first couple of months in 1992, it's obvious that there was a systematic plan in place, because what happened in my municipality, I'm talking about Bosnia Nationalist Serb plan, it happened in exactly the same fashion all over the country. Exactly the same things took place. So my place was attacked, and then what they regarded to be men of fighting age were separated from women and children. And then women and children who suffered, a lot of degrading treatment, and then they would be expelled to the part of the Bosnian territory which was controlled by the Bosnian government, and men of fighting age would be kept behind. So when my village was attacked, a couple of weapons that we had, we surrendered. And then the explanation they gave us was that we would be taken to the biggest two towns in the region to stay with, you know, relatives until the situation calmed down. But it didn't make any sense, because by that point in time, they had full control over my village. And unfortunately, yeah, they put us in these concentration camps.
Moving again from the concentration camp situation to your liberation from the concentration camp situation, how did that come about?
Towards the end of my stay in the first camp, some three British journalists arrived in the camp. And Radovan Karadzic was in London at the time, and one journalist put a lot of pressure on him regarding Karadzic and his men running concentration camps in Bosnia. Then Karadzic, he denied this accusation, and he invited whoever was prepared to come and look for those camps. And I'm rather pleased that he did that, because these three journalists were persistent enough to enter the Omarska camp, and when they showed images of the camp to the world became outraged, even though that footage didn't really reflect what went on in the camp for the previous 2.5 months. Still, it was enough to put enough pressure on the Serb authorities to quickly close down this camp, and then I was taken to another camp where it was horrible, but there was no immediate threat to my life. And after more than 4 months of being kept in this camp, it was impossible to survive in the winter of 1992 because we were kept in cow sheds. And then finally, we were released on a condition to leave Bosnia for good.
During this Bosnian war, before being taken to the concentration camps, did you witness many atrocities?
Not really. Nothing really happened in my region before we were attacked by the Serbian nationalist forces. There was no almost any kind of violence. You know, the war in Croatia was so close to home, but I didn't witness anything in person. Maybe that's why I decided not to leave when I had a chance to leave.
Let's move on from that, Kemal, and just talk about, maybe go back to the present day, if you feel like doing that.
Sure.
Looking at the arrest now of Radovan Karadzic, and looking also at the situation where there are others that are wanted for war crimes, like Radko Mladic and others, is it your hope that Serbia can use all its means to capture these men and others and bring them to justice?
I feel a little bit suspicious about the Serbian government and them arresting Karadzic now when, some 2 months after they had lost a presidential election. And, this was quite convenient for them because this will help them to join the European Union at some point in the future. And also this will open the gates for huge European grants to be given to the Serbian government. But in spite of being a little bit cynical about the whole thing, I feel it's really great that Karadzic was arrested by the Serbian security forces rather than, you know, Bosnian security forces or NATO forces. And the job isn't done because Ratko Mladic in many ways is far more important than Karadzic, and this must not stop here. So I really hope that Serbian forces will arrest Mladic in the near future as well, because it can offer real hope for the future process of reconciliation, which will be necessary because we need a long-lasting peace in the region, and it can't happen without, you know, reconciliation.
Kemal, do you think this arrest will help in some way to healing the wounds that so many people have suffered over these years?
One of my biggest hopes is that by putting Karadzic on trial, the Serb people, whether in Bosnia or in Serbia, will learn a lot more what this man did to non-Serbs between 92 and 95. And that can be only good, you know, for Bosnia and for its neighbors. And also, this arrest of Karadzic, it's not just about justice for people like myself, you know, for his former victims. This is far more significant. This man didn't preside over genocide of non-Serbs in Bosnia, mainly over Muslims in Bosnia. This man has committed crimes against humanity, you know, against humanity as a whole. And his successful conviction might serve as a deterrent to any current day dictators who might think of committing similar crimes in the future. And they should all know that their crimes would never go unpunished.
Can I ask you, Kemal, have you been back?
I've been back several times. Ironically, I went back for the first time on the 10th anniversary of the attack on my village, and I wasn't even aware of that. I've been going back almost every year.
Your village was, if you can even describe your village and the name of your village, a normal, everyday village that you would see, I'm sure, throughout the country.
My village is called Kirljani, and it was, you know, just an ordinary Bosnian village where most people lived and worked as subsistence farmers, because our fathers mainly worked on construction sites all over the country, you know, as laborers, and you know, to supplement our living, we would actually work our land, and life was really, really beautiful.
Having gone back again, do you feel now that it can recreate that beauty that it had before?
Life was really beautiful, and we didn't have much, but we were quite happy, and it was a small community of some 600 people, and as we were taken away from the village in May 1992, every single building was still left intact behind. And when I went back for the first time 10 years later, all I saw was grass and rubble. If you can imagine, you know, somebody taking you away from your street today, and then you go back 10 years later, and all you can see is wildlife, you know, grass and rubble. That's how it was 10 years ago. And gradually some people started going back. But it's mainly all the people who want to die there and people who feel nostalgic, who live in Australia or in the States, and who decided to rebuild their homes, and they're never going to live permanently. And then the community is really dead, and the community will never be brought back to life again.
Today, Kamal lives and works in England. He has made a new life for himself and has written an inspiring account of his life in Bosnia and in the camps, entitled The Killing Days. As we have heard from his own voice, reconciliation is key in the building of a future of peace, but never must the past be forgotten or distorted. Spain's World Cup champions flew home from South Africa on Monday for a huge celebration, including meetings with the Spanish King and Prime Minister and an open-air bus ride through Madrid's historic centre, where fans lined the streets to cheer them on and thank them for their winning performances. The team beat the Netherlands in Johannesburg on Sunday night in the final match of what is generally perceived to have been an extremely successful football World Cup championship. Successful, it appears, at many different levels. An event that has turned out to be much more than just a feast for sport, as Cardinal Wilfred Fox Napier, Archbishop of Durban, told Vatican Radio.
The first thing I think that the World Cup will leave in South Africa is a sense of South Africans becoming a part of the world community and having been the focus of the world for an entire month. That can only be to our advantage that we recognize ourselves as being an important part of the world community. I think that's the most important thing that will have happened. We believe in ourselves, we can see that we can do things, and we don't have to wait for other people to do them for us. I think that's going to be the most important legacy of the World Cup.
And what about the significance of sport within a historically divided society? Has it proved to be for rugby when South Africa won the World Cup back in 1995? Do you think sport still represents a unifying element for South Africans?
Yes, definitely. The World Cup in particular, because football is the main sport of the vast majority of the people of South Africa, in particular the black people. And for them to have the World Cup in soccer coming to their country has meant that they feel they've been recognized by the world community as being an important part of the world family of football. So I think that's one of the great things that it will have done. It has reunited the people into believing that they are part of this bigger community.
And what if we take a different slant? Do you think that South Africa has paid a social price for organising the event?
It is possible to say that because funds will have been diverted into stadiums and infrastructure and things of that nature. So one could argue that there was a social price that was paid in the sense that those funds, or some of those funds, could have been used to build schools or improve schools or the hospital services, the health services, and so on. But I think when we do the final tally of pros and cons, those things, advantages and disadvantages of having the World Cup, we will find that the infrastructure that was improved is going to benefit everybody. The fact that we can do things with money that is put into our hands means that we can do the same now with more confidence in education, in healthcare, and so on. The only thing that remains, I believe, is for our politicians, our government, to have the political will to do with the same determination what they did for the World Cup, to do that for their people when the focus of the world is not on us.
And what about South Africa, the Rainbow Nation? Is that really reality, or is it still a dream?
It's an ideal. I think it is still a dream, but it is a dream that is being realized in small portions, but I think it is being realized. For instance, I find it hard to believe that when I look back 15 years, 16 years, when it was still an object of amazement to see a black person and a white person walking together, when to engage in conversation across the cultural lines, the color lines, was an effort. And today you find children and parents mixing as if they've known each other all their lives. For me, that has part of the dream is coming true. There's still a long way to go, but thank God we're getting good enough evidence that we can do it, and so we can continue trying to do it.
Do you think the World Cup has had a positive effect on the rest of Africa as well?
Absolutely, I'm certain of that. The fact that we had 2 years ago in South Africa a very, very negative experience of xenophobic attacks on people from other parts of Africa. That was a real surprise for us, because so many of our own black people from South Africa had found refuge as exiles in different African countries. And here were people from those countries who have come as exiles to our country, and they were being attacked. I think the World Cup has brought about a sense of solidarity with other African countries, because those countries themselves declared long before, just after we won the World Cup, to stage the World Cup, they said, this is not an event for South Africa, this is an event for Africa. And throughout the preparation, and especially during the actual holding of the championship, South African leaders have been saying, this is an African event and not a South African event. I think that will make a bigger impression on the unity of Africa than a lot of words by a politician could ever have done.
And finally, how about a comment on your own team, the Bafana Bafanas? Did you follow the matches?
Very much so, yes. I follow that with great interest, especially how from the first match, a very, very good match they played, in the second half in particular. The next match was a disaster. I think overconfidence or something happened. I'm not sure what it was, but they really didn't play the way that they should have played. And then the third match against France, in the first half, I think they played an excellent match, passing the ball around. In the second half, there were changes in the personnel on the team, and individuals came there who thought this was their chance to shine on the world, and they lost that plan of being a team, and individuals were trying to perform. And I think that's why we didn't get the result that we could possibly have had against France. We should have been just about able to qualify, but I think the change in the attitude of the players disappointed.
That was Cardinal Wilfred Fox Napier, Archbishop of Durban. That's all from the English feature programme today, and from me, Linda Bordoni. But we will be back at the same time tomorrow. So join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English programme. Laudetur Jesus Christus.